On the evening of the day he became the 32nd President of the United States, Franklin D. Roosevelt, good Episcopalian that he was having a glass of bourbon and preparing for bed. The world beyond the second floor of the White House seemed to be falling apart. One out of every four American men was out of work. There was violence in the countryside. Bankers on Wall Street were plotting to overthrow the new president by force of arms. Elite opinion makers worried that democracy was doomed. The American experiment in self-government seemed destined to collapse as fascism marched through Europe. Amid these swirling currents of despair, a Roosevelt advisor called on the new president to say goodnight. He told FDR, "Sir, if you succeed in saving the country, you will go down as our greatest president. But if you fail, you will go down as our worst." FDR looked at him and said, "If I fail, I'll go down as our last." So we have been here before, to some measure and some degree. Anxieties about the decline and fall of the Republic, about a corrosive and cancerous public life, about a nation hopelessly sundered by competing understandings of power and identity, are not new. History, though, may offer perspective. But just because something has happened before does not mean it's not happening now. Inescapably, the problems of our time remain the problems of our time. We are gathered here in the early evening of an autumn day in the 242nd year of our independence, not because things are going well in the public square, but because things manifestly are not. This is not a cable news point. It is not a Twitter point. It's not a Republican point or a Democratic point or a red point or a blue point. It's not a religious point or a secular point. It is simply a self-evident point. Those with eyes to see and ears to hear know that the country is more fractured than whole, more sulfurous than serene. And so here we are, at this hour in this sacred place, to pray for healing and for hope. In the gospel lesson we just heard, Jesus said, in a moment of great darkness, the greatest darkness, really, a moment of death, that we should not fear, only believe. Only believe. But what should we only believe? So here's my attempt at an answer. As Americans in the first decades of the 21st century, we should believe in our power to overcome, if only for a time, our worst instincts, and to heed what Lincoln called the better angels of our nature. It's a matter of history that in our finest hours, we have opened our arms and not clenched our fists, reached out, not turned inward, accepted, not rejected, hoped, not feared. Americans thrive when we put into action a belief in fair play, in generosity of spirit, and in an expansive understanding of what Thomas Jefferson meant when he wrote what became the most important sentence in the English language, that all men are created equal. I will admit to hesitating to make hyperbolic claims about the English language based largely on the old story about the Texas school board candidate who was running against the teaching of Spanish in the public schools and said on the stump, "If English was good enough for our Lord Jesus Christ, it's good enough for Texas." As I like to remind our friends in Texas, if it weren't for us, they'd still be part of Spain. So I made that joke to George W. Bush once when he was governor, and he went, "That's really funny, you jerk." I know some of this can seem gauzy or even naive, but perfection cannot be the goal in a fallen world. We will fall short. We will make mistakes. I do all the time. Thankfully, we learn more from sinners than we do from saints, which is a good thing given the relative proportion of the former to the latter in the general population. In our tradition, we are taught that all things shall be made new only in the last days, not in these. In the meantime, and much of life is lived in the meantime, we are called by conscience and experience to make life less difficult for one another. The roots of such a sensibility, I believe, begin with an appreciation of the past. To know what's come before is to be armed against despair. If the men and women of previous ages could press on through ignorance and superstition, racism and sexism, selfishness and greed, to create a freer, stronger nation, then perhaps we can too. And perhaps we can take another step toward that most enchanting and elusive of destinations, a more perfect union. Nostalgia, to be sure, is a powerful force. Much in us wants us to believe that the past was more perfect than the present. But it wasn't. And this is a fundamental point. For where does our story, represented at this altar and at the foot of this cross, begin? It begins with the fall and the expulsion from paradise. And the motive events of the story of Jesus were necessary not because everything was fine, but precisely because it wasn't. We try, we fail, but we must try again and again and again, for only in trial is progress possible. And those trials must allow, as painful as sometimes it is, for seeing the other side's point. Respect for others is not incompatible with holding one's own convictions. It is, in fact, part of the marrow of Anglicanism, and the church into which I and many of you were born is uniquely positioned to lead in divided times, not least because it itself was forged amid dispute and dissension. We acknowledge that the peace of God passeth all understanding, and yet we seek it hour by hour and year by year and from generation to generation. And while we've been promised that the gates of hell shall not finally prevail, we've also been taught that for now we only see through a glass darkly. So we live in hope and seek at our best to do so humbly. For who has searched the mind of the Lord or been his counselor? Surely not me, and nobody I know, and I dare say no one you know either. Too many people, however, are like the old story of the pastor who meets up with an old friend who is a member of a different denomination, and they talked about their faith and their lives, and they realized it was a lovely occasion. And as they were parting, the pastor said, "Yes, we do both worship the same God, you in your way and I in his." So, the beginning of a reasonable faith and a reasonable citizenship lies, I think, in the acknowledgement that we live in twilight more often than we do in certainty. No party has a monopoly on truth. And the psalmist reminded us long ago to put not thy trust in princes, even if, especially if, he's your prince. This is why the gift of reason is so essential, for to fail to approach the action of our time with intelligence and with a sense of history risks sending us off to seek comfort in the literal, putting all our faith in one side or the other. To make America great requires making America reasonable. A final thought. Progress in our country does not usually come except when the whispered hopes of those outside the mainstream rise in volume to reach the ears and minds and hearts of the powerful. And those voices carry the farthest when they call for fairness, not for favors, for justice, not for undue advantage. Such voices, articulating the feelings of innumerable others, did ultimately prevail in the causes of emancipation and of suffrage. Yes, it took presidential and legislative action to make things official. A Lincoln to free the slaves, a Woodrow Wilson to support the woman suffrage amendment, a Lyndon Johnson to finish the fight against Jim Crow. But without the voices from afar, without our voices, there would be no chorus of liberty. So let us lift our voices and sing.